Hello and welcome to the Private Capital Podcast. I'm Joe Riley, and I've been in the family office investing world for over 20 years. Today we have Alex Chaloff, who is the CIO of Bernstein Private Wealth Management. We had a great conversation talking about his personal litmus test for a manager, what to do with lagging funds, the advantages of scale, and the importance of having a sleep coach. Alex is the Chief Investment Officer of Bernstein Private Wealth Management. Before his current role, he served as head of alternative asset strategies. Alex was also a senior investment strategist and co-head of Bernstein's Private Client Investment Policy Group, the decision-making body for the private client business. Before joining Bernstein in 2005, he was a managing director at Wilshire Associates, serving on the firm's investment committee. Alex earned a BA in government and politics from the University of Maryland, College Park, and an MBA with a concentration in finance from the Marshall School of Business at the University of Southern California. If you like these discussions, please subscribe or leave a review. And please enjoy my talk with Alex Chaloff.
This podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only. Anything said by the guests or host should not be construed as legal or investment advice. Thanks for listening.
We usually start with your earliest interest in investing.
My earliest interest in investing was as a young kid in outside Boston. There was one that you could take your pick of the number of brand name Boston-based investment management companies. And I opened an account with one of them when I was 11 or 12 years old and bought a mutual fund that was highly recognized at the time, run by a very prominent person. And that was before the internet and before email, of course. And so I read everything. I don't think I understood everything as an 11 and 12 and 13 year old even that I was reading, but I would look at prospectuses. I read the shareholder letters. I loved it. And I had...
I assume you're talking about Peter Lynch.
I am. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And I read all the way through, let's see, this is probably early 80s. I don't know what year he started managing Magellan, but I was an investor in 84, somewhere in the house I have my original statement. But yes, started then and really was hooked, just loved it. And that's all I've ever wanted to do. That's been my focus ever since.
Did you ever consider any other careers?
I thought a little bit about politics when I was in high school. I did Model UN and debate club and this type of activity. And I thought, boy, this could be interesting to affect change. And I actually pursued a degree at University of Maryland at College Park in poli-sci, government and politics, as they call it. And I did think I wanted to go into politics, but the pull of the asset management industry was too strong.
Were there any other particular individuals, obviously outside of Peter Lynch, who influenced your perspective on investing, like Buffett?
I would not say Buffett. There was a guy, Louis Rukeyser. You remember Louis?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. So I watched religiously and read. I started getting Barron's very early on. So a lot of people that now no longer write for Barron's, and I'm not even sure they're alive. But Rukeyser is a guy who I ended up meeting a few times and sticks out in my memory as somebody that I was influential. Don't get caught up in fads, long-term investor. Really, that's been my approach as well, but I thought the world of him.
And was there any particular mentor that you look back on who really helped you along the way, either shape your investment philosophy or helped you as a leader?
I have had the good fortune of working for a number of terrific people who were selfless. I can think when I worked in my first job in Boston, I worked for a woman, Carol Loud, who really taught me how just to get the job done and don't get mixed up in anything else, but doing the right thing for your client was a waste of time. I worked for a former client as an intern in business school for a gentleman named Jim Atkinson. Then it was Guinness Flight, then it was Investec, and Jim has his own flag now. And Jim was just super creative, open to new ideas. Now, here I am as an intern giving him advice and he's open to it. He's terrific. at Bernstein, I've had the good fortune of working for people like Diane Loeb and Kathy Fisher, who were incredible leaders, really talented mentors that both had reached a point in their career where it was less about them and more about me, and gave me exposure on the stage and guided me in a direction that was just so wise. So I've had terrific people throughout my career that I'm extremely thankful for.
Okay, so you started at Wilshire out of business school. What kind of lessons did you learn there? Were there any frameworks that were particularly useful?
Yeah, I think so Wilshire is a global investment consulting firm, I think of as a world leader in that space. I worked in the consulting team that focused on both manager selection and asset allocation. So I got a chance to meet, I was not a manager research professional, I was more of a client-facing person at that firm. I got to meet hundreds of managers over the course of my career there and really learn what separates the good from the great, from the average. And I would just say the process that I learned was in each asset class having a set of criteria that was consistent. So if you met with a core plus manager, really this not just the set of questions, but the evaluation, the process, the metrics, they should be very consistent. And I think that allowed you to take a small manager and compare them to a large manager from a steady to an opportunistic. It really allowed you to put everybody in the same sandbox and make good decisions based on that. I think it also, the process there has really taught me a lot about separating who was great from who will be great. I think we get lured in, all of us in the investment management industry get lured in with great returns. Oh my gosh, look at what they've done over the last 3 years. That's important, but it doesn't matter. It's not the only thing. If you had a terrific 3 years, but that was with $100 million and now you've got $4 billion, that's a different manager. If you had a terrific 3 years, but two of the top lieutenants left to start their own firm, that's a different manager. So I think it was really just giving my first opportunity to step into the evaluator and capital allocator role. It's invaluable. And I'm so thankful for the time that I spent there.
When you started at Bernstein, you were a PM. What was your focus?
I was a senior portfolio manager, more of a generalist in nature. I think at that time in 2005, Bernstein had a limited portfolio, more focused, I'll say, of large cap value and large cap growth in the US, a diversified exposure in EFA and EM, and then core bonds. So there wasn't enough that you couldn't know everything. So I could tell you at a moment's notice the top 10 holdings in each of our portfolios, the positioning, credit, duration. I knew what was going on in all of them. So for the first few years, I was truly a generalist.
And then you moved to head of alt at Bernstein. Do you have your own personal litmus test for a manager, something you can't quantify?
I do. It's called hunger. I like to go with managers that have not yet shot the moon and are really looking to do it. They're looking for you, not just as a capital allocator, but as a thought partner. So I think from a culture standpoint, I want somebody who is hungry because I'm hungry. And I want to make sure that groups that we're working with and PMs in particular have that. So I don't know how you quantify that, but I would just say I like working with people who are hungry.
And what are the signs of that? How do you sort for that?
I think there's a list, and without being dogmatic about it, I think number one is their willingness to engage. It's something as silly as how easy it is to schedule the first handful of discussions. Are they willing to move things around? Do they want to meet with you this week, today, versus I'm not open till June? Things like that. I think very early on, if they're not all in the dating process, then once you get married, you don't have a chance. I think first is just their desire to get on your calendar and really have active engagement. I think second is, are they a talker or a listener? And I remember I met with this group that we did not end up engaging with. And in a 60-minute discussion, this gentleman spoke for 58. And 58 straight. Like at a certain point, we were messaging each other, the people on my side of the table, wow, this is really impressive. This guy is just not stopping. That's not somebody I want to work with, because that's not someone my clients want to engage with. Talk for an app, you know, 60 minutes, you're talking for 58. So I think it's a willingness to have an engagement level that's great, not just be in the meeting and be present, but really hear what's interesting on my side of the table. I think it's take direction. There's been a number of situations where I've been in a meeting where someone's got a range of returns page. I remember very vividly a range of returns. If here's our base case, if spreads were to blow out, I'd be here. If they were to compress, they'd be here. And there were it wasn't intuitive. Like in this specific situation, it was a credit plus manager, almost high yield. That made sense to me, but I didn't think anyone else would get it. It was very wonky. And I had to stop him. And I said, I think there's an easier way to show this. And we were in his office at the time. He had a whiteboard. He gave me a marker. He said, go for it. And I drew it up and he said, okay, that's better than what we've got. And part of me said, okay, this guy's like really selling me right now, that he wants me to feel like he not just listened. But then it was in the materials. He changed it. So I think it's this willingness to again, back to this idea of being a thought partner. That's really important.
It's interesting because Bernstein works with institutions, individuals, retail. Do you find that there's upward pressure sometimes to push the firm towards brand names?
No, I would say we're probably in the opposite camp. We've made a concerted effort to look away from the megas, because in my view, anybody can get you the megas. And what value am I going to have in allocating to a $20 billion private equity or $20 billion real estate or $10 billion? You get the point. You don't need me. Literally Google it and they'll take your money. Where we've added the most value, and by the way, had success to the point where I've outperformed those mega managers, is in middle market. And I know middle market now is tossed around. It's everywhere. But I really think that there are some interesting opportunities in not just new and emerging managers, but managers that have been steadfast in their belief that they need to have a hard cap, that they're on fund eight and they're still a middle market and they're totally happy to be there. So I don't think that that's not where we played. And I'm very comfortable with that approach.
What's your definition of middle market? I see those brackets. They sometimes expand nowadays.
I know. It used to be, we were joking when I started, what was small cap was 500 million and now it's 2 billion. Now it's 4 billion. I don't even know what small cap is anymore. I think of middle market, it differs by the asset class. So private equity, private credit, to call out two. But what I think of them is the actual deal size. So what are the checks that you're writing? And if somebody writes a check, an equity check for 50 to 100, to me, that's at the lower end of the middle market. If you're writing checks for 750 in that neighborhood, I think that's at the upper end of the market. So just from a transaction basis, I think of that's how I think of the middle market. The second way is what the fund size is, or in something that's more evergreen, the platform size. And I think that tends to vary. But if you go back to the underlying asset, that's what I'm comfortable with thinking about for middle market.
And how do you know when to support a lagging manager and when to let go?
Ooh, boy, that's tough. When I was at Wilshire, we used to analyze the performance of terminated managers versus hired managers. There's industry studies. We've done it in-house at Bernstein. It's really hard. I think there's a handful of things that would allow me to maintain conviction. Performance ebbs and flows. I think we all know that. You hire a manager, you allocate capital to a manager because they have expressed a point of view around where their edge is and what their market is. And so as long as they're maintaining, they're still playing in the same market, they haven't changed, they haven't switched styles or market cap or geography, easy stuff that you can track, but also that they haven't gone outside of what I would characterize as their wheelhouse. I think that gives me more comfort to stay with. I've had a number of situations where we've had to close out positions over time from managers who said, look, I'm really good at X, shorting. Nobody can short like I can. I'm an amazing shorter. And they've had good performance, but it hasn't come from the shorts. And actually, when you really dig in, the shorts have detracted. And so if you hired them because you thought they were really a hedge and yet their performance is great, I've had to shut off those types of managers in the past. And it's the right thing to do because even though their performance has been okay slash good, how they got there was not what we signed up for. So to me, I think it's, are they true to their style? Are they doing what they told you they do? The last thing I would add as another point is individual names. So how different names ended up in the portfolio. So the process of which they got there, I'm thinking of misses. You meet with the manager, they're underperforming. They show, here's the five detractors. Okay, let's go through what analysts proposed, these ideas. What was the process of getting in the portfolio? What were the points in time that you had new information that maybe would have forced you to change your view? It's digging in on individual names to understand that. And there's times where we've had managers that are woefully underperforming, but they've done exactly what they said they would do, and their research has been spot on. They're much more willing to give them a break. But I do think that there are certain things that pop up that are pretty easy to identify that either give you confidence to hang in there. We have a team inside Bernstein that was having a really tough 2015. I don't know if you remember the 2015 into 16 experience. Markets were choppy. These guys were S&P focused, and their performance was dismal. But what they had was a collection of names where the earnings growth was actually terrific. The guidance was strong. The results were good. Their research was bang on, but the prices hadn't moved. And so we stayed, and actually I dialed up our conviction in allocating to them. And then all of a sudden they all got paid. All the stocks that had been under pressure because of what was going on in their industry were appreciated for what they were actually doing. So I guess it's a long-winded way of saying it's a mosaic. It's not one thing, but it's over time you can get comfortable with different aspects. So I think, look, that's a challenge of being an allocator. And I think you have to identify who you're investing for. My pool of capital looks different than say a family office that has either a single family or a handful of families. They can understand who the various beneficiaries are, the owners of the capital. You have to invest for your capital pool. And so I might be willing to let somebody have a longer rope than maybe someone else. I have the good fortune of having a diversified platform. So I don't want to say never, but very rarely does a Bernstein client own a single strategy. So it's, again, back to this idea of multiple points. So it's a different equation for everybody. To me, it's as long as you're sticking true to what you're investing in from the outset and how you got there, I'm more tolerant of underperformance. But at a certain point, if there's you trade away from what you originally position yourself as, then we've got to move on. That's how we look at it.
When you're looking across the client base, how do you manage that tension between the institutional and the private wealth and the demands of both?
I spend the vast majority of my time in the private wealth land, overseeing the investment platform for a private wealth business. I do work with institutional investors and engage closely with investment teams that have only institutional investors. To me, and I've spent before I got to Bernstein, albeit almost 20 years ago, I spent my life in the institutional world. I think there it's a little bit different. The institutional business has more of an asset liability matching feel to it. Asset allocation ranges are the strictest there. There really is very little flex around making adjustments or trying to be tactical, not that there's anything wrong with it. They're trying to solve a different problem. To me, the private wealth business is really exciting because our investors are, number one, more flexible with their asset allocation. So we establish an initial capital allocation approach and with some ranges we're within that, but they're also more willing to take on potentially more opportunistic ideas and do so at a time where institutions are pulling back because of other, again, back to the math of what they're trying to solve for. So I think of today as a perfect example. Institutional LPs, by and large, over allocated to private market investments from 2014-15 through 2021. And 2022 in the public markets was just a disaster. So their public portfolios got smashed. And at the same time, the private portfolios actually did quite well. And so they have investment policy statements back to this rigid guidelines that they have to have. They were out of balance with their investment policy statements. And so the only way to get back to IPS range was to, number one, stop making new investments. And number two, look to opportunistically be a seller into the secondary market of their legacy investments. And so our clients, private wealth clients, I would say, again, I don't want to make this a Bernstein specific idea, but broadly across the industry, private investors have liquidity. They have that dry powder. They have a willingness to engage in opportunistic ideas, not on a perma basis, but when it's really interesting, they'll step in. And they're doing so in an environment where there's more sellers and less new capital. So I think of today's environment going into private markets, either buying up assets that have become newly discounted or buying pools of assets from willing sellers. It's a really interesting time that you're going to have a completely different set of behaviors on the institutional space relative to the private wealth space.
So maybe we could get a little bit granular about your process. I'm interested in how you think about the overall allocation, how you work with your team, and quite frankly, how you deal with all of the information that's coming at you.
Dealing with all the information, I love coffee, is what I would say, is the first thing. The other thing is you can track your sleep now. And sleep is probably the most important asset that any one of us has. And so I have a routine. I hired a sleep coach. I don't think there's anything more Los Angeles than hiring a sleep. Oh, it's amazing. Joe, you got to look at it. It's really incredible. There are things you can do to set yourself up for a successful night's sleep, even when you're highly stressed.
Can I stop you for a second? Is there any advantages? I interviewed Mike Milken, actually. Is there any advantages to being out in LA?
Yes. There's incredible advantages of being in Los Angeles. Number one, the footnote, caveat, 48 point font, you have to be a morning person. I'm up in the fours. It's just, since 2001, I've been a professional on the West Coast and I've been getting up early ever since. And it's human nature. It's totally fine. So I think number one, everything that comes along with lifestyle and weather and wonderful setting. I love the entrepreneurial feel of the West Coast. I grew up in Boston and spent almost 30 years there. That was more of a established business community. Up and down the East Coast, especially in the Northeast, Southern California, Los Angeles, and obviously Northern California have more of a blank sheet of paper feel to it. So I think the energy that comes in this business community is exceptional. And I would just say selfishly, a lot of people stop emailing me around 1:30 p.m. And so you can, if you build your day, you're busy early, but you can really have some real productivity time in the afternoon. So that in the evening, you can be present for people who are important to you.
So we'll get back to process. How do you manage your teams and all of the information coming at you?
So the first step is quantitative tools. So we have two really important quantitative tools that we use that really are the bedrock of our asset allocation and capital allocation advice. The first is an asset allocation tool that takes inputs around balance sheet size, spending, taxation. Think of all of the guts of what it is that is important to you as an investor and plugs it in. And we build not a Monte Carlo, it's more of a structured Monte Carlo scenario analysis that pops out of that where we run 10,000 different scenarios. And it allows you to really be informed about what your investment experience will look like so that you can make informed asset allocation decisions. So then you start with your baseline. I want to be this much in safe and this much in risk, just at a very high level. And then what we do is by the way, that's very important for investors because I think a lot of people either start with 60-40 and just say, I'll be 60-40. I heard that's what you should do. Or they start with something that's just more rule of thumb as opposed to something that's built on precision. So number one is building a precise model around asset allocation. The byproduct, by the way, of that work is also for our clients that have significant balance sheets, we do a further analysis of what we call core versus surplus. this is a Bernstein speak, but I think it's applicable for anyone that is looking at their own balance sheet, or if you're running a family office, how you're building out capital allocations, or you're an institutional capital allocator. It's really this idea of what's known, what is the liabilities side of the business versus where can you be more aggressive with your asset pool. And so we quantify what is core is essentially the size of the portfolio. If allocated conservatively, that would endow your lifestyle for a reasonable period of time of your life. Core is really important in establishing the guardrails around a conservative component of the allocation. And surplus, just as important, that's money you can gift to future generations, you can be charitable with, or you can invest aggressively, more aggressively than you would in your core. And so that means it can be probably more illiquid. It can have a different risk profile. It can have less of a focus on cash flow. It can do different things. It can stretch for you. Core versus surplus is a revolutionary discovery for people that are just starting with capital. I have a number of friends in the industry that have taken brand new CIO roles at family offices, and they've engaged us for this core versus surplus analysis just to get a feel for what their pool could look like as they provide advice to their respective asset owners. What sounds intuitive for those of us who have spent our entire careers in this space, it really is, it creates some real insights for people that are just getting started here. From that, we then take that asset allocation and build it through a quantitative tool that we built about 5 years ago called the Alternative Impact Analysis. And what this does is we've modeled every asset class on the planet, every investable asset class on the planet, I should say, as well as every strategy that we manage on our platform. And you can ask the tool to do a couple of things. Number one, you can say solve for the highest return. So if I don't care about risk, what collection of portfolios would deliver the highest Sharpe, but the highest return? So you optimize first for return. Number two, you could do the opposite. You could say, give me the lowest risk portfolio with the highest return trade-off. Number three, you could do the same thing for income. You could say, give me the most cash flow I could possibly get without taking on the highest risk. Or the fourth, which most of our clients pick, is you tell me what to do. If you had discretion, there's a button to push, which basically optimizes for Sharpe. And you end up with an asset allocation recommendation moving from a traditional fully liquid core strategies into something that has more of an alternative feel to it. We manage the sourcing, we manage the capital call funding advice, we manage everything around that whole process. But long story short, using these two quantitative tools takes us from everything that's available to you in the capital markets to ultimately what your appropriate portfolio looks like.
Being in the markets for 20 years, do you think allocation can be taught, or is there some sort of art to it?
Wow, I had not thought about that. Certainly, I think there's art because every situation is different. So I think there's some art to it. But I do think that there are basics, building blocks, foundational building blocks of asset allocation that are consistent across situations. So I think number one, equity risk premium, that this idea that equities pay off more than a risk-free rate over time. Number two, illiquidity premium, that while just like equity risk premium that ebbs and flows over time, so too did this illiquidity premium, which is exceptionally high today, but in 2021 wasn't so terrific. So I think there are things like that are consistent, but then it's what you do with them or maybe how you message them that is the art.
Does your own exposure to clients who are themselves great investors help you?
I think so. I love dealing with clients. It's fun. And I'm prideful about our investment platform. And so it gives me a chance to talk about things that are like my children, which gets me excited. But I also do respect a number of our clients' points of view, and I do seek them out. I also, though, I do sometimes have to take what clients tell me with a grain of salt for a number of different reasons. Number one, everyone thinks they're a risk taker when they're granted a new pool of capital. So part of my job and the wealth advisors at Bernstein, their job is to caution people about going high octane right off the bat. By the same token, I think a lot of investors who have been burned in the past, 2000, 2008. I mentioned 15, 16 was tricky. 18, 19, COVID, 22, these mini corrections that have popped up. I think sometimes clients where they're investing with their own capital can be, get burned and never want to reengage or come at it with such a level of skepticism, permanent skepticism, that I feel like I've got to move them back to center. So while I do listen to what clients are expressing as it relates to product development, what ideas are on their mind that I could potentially build something around to solve. And there's a couple of things that I'm working on now that came directly as a result of client discussions. I also have to measure how much to take from different clients given their own personal investment experience.
Has Bernstein changed the way it engages with venture capital? Do you find their capacity constraints an issue?
I think in venture, we have been slow to engage. So in the period of the late 2010s, just dipping very small exposure, and people inside the firm and outside the firm were beating up on me to get venture, more venture. I want every venture. I love the book Shogun and this idea of just delay until you're in a better position. Delay until you have more information. I don't pat myself on the back that much, but I'm going to pat myself on the back for dragging my feet on venture going into 2022. Now, it only works if you can get the other side right too. So we were good in that we didn't have overexposure to venture. So we're not getting beaten up the waiting for the new marks to come out is not keeping me up at night because we don't have that much exposure there. But now it's interesting. Now I'd love to expand, and we have been doing this, expanding our venture exposure for a couple of different reasons. Number one, the values have reset in that space. While the down rounds haven't been as plentiful as I think they will be, we're getting a little bit of a backdoor. We have a venture debt business that's getting us in, and we're seeing some really interesting opportunities where we're taking some equity co or maybe some warrants. We're doing some interesting stuff in venture debt. So I don't think you have to wait until the down rounds before you can be benefiting from this. And then number two, we're getting calls from funds that had been hard closed for years and years because they want our money. And back to this idea of institutional LPs taking a couple of years off, the venture community is at the forefront of that. So I love the fact that we dragged our feet going into this. And I hope if we talk again in 2 or 3 years, I've told you a success story about how we made the other side work. Because I think the world isn't forever changed by 2022. Just the prices have been changed. And I think now is the opportunity. It's probably a 24, 25, 26 type of opportunity. But I think the window is open to invest nicely, i.e. in more deals at lower valuations than we have in the last 20 years. Slow in, but that will be, and that was intentional. And now is the time to act.
Have you seen any flexibility on fees?
Oh, I have not. I saw 2.5, and they were 2.5 and 20, and they were sticking to it. So I haven't seen in venture fees. Where I have seen a lot of break on fees is in real estate. I've had a number of groups that want to be on the Bernstein platform come with GP participation. I've had that in hedge funds, a lot of GP participation from hedge funds. Venture is the break that they've given so far has been access to fund allocations with the promise of the zero fee, zero carry co-invest. I think that's what they're saying. Look, our fund will be smaller, so we'll have more of an ability to give you that free co-invest. And that's the fee break that you're going to get. And that's okay. I think that's okay.
So private credit's very hot. Blackstone just raised $10 billion. Carlyle just raised $9 billion. KKR and Apollo have large strategies. I'm curious if your research leads you to believe that there's a limit to how much quality credit is actually out there.
There are concerns around private credit. I think the concern that we have is less so because of what's going on in the banking space. So if everything was functioning normally, I would be concerned about private credit because there was an explosion in capital raised, not just recently, but really over the last 3 or 4 years. And we have our own private credit business that does a great job, and it gives me terrific visibility into what's going on in the market by the virtue of what deals we are not awarded. I see what we bid on, what we win, what we lose, and what the ultimate winner, if you will, air quotation mark, winner of that deal, how they structured it. What was the coupon? I don't know the covenants, but I can guess because I know what we bid on. There's going to be a massive amount of private credit failures over the next few years. Thankfully, I'm going to go on record. It will not be originated by AB, but there will be originated by others. I get excited because I think some of the money that's out there that you just referenced will probably go as a buyer of those notes in the secondary market at a reprice. The issuer, the original owner of that debt, will take that loss. And you as a new investor can buy that up. So I think part of the capital has been raised. I hope we'll go after that. The other part of this is banks are not functioning normally as a result of what happened with Silicon Valley and First Republic, et cetera. That's an aftershock that takes years to work through. So if you look at, I've got a great page in my materials that I share with our investors. Credit extension on the part of banks has fallen off a cliff for commercial, industrial, real estate, really all CRE. Corporate credit is way, way down. I think if you're a good company and you would have otherwise chosen to go through a bank, the bank's not super active and you're looking to the private credit markets for finance because you're not big enough for public debt or someone's telling you you can't use the public debt market. So I think the fact that the banks have slowed/stopped lending has created a window where I think it's less risky than it otherwise would have been. You got to be careful. I don't want to say just blanket dump money into private credit, but I think had the banks been functioning normally, I would have been a lot more concerned around what's going on now. The fact that they're not gives me some comfort, believe it or not.
What's a worst case scenario for the private credit space?
I think it's a spike in rates. I think it's big pickup in rates counter to what we and others in the market believe that you're going to have some moderation in rates. If the 10-year was at 6, you'd have private credit failures galore. And then you as the private debt issuer, you've got a decision. Do I want to take back this company or do I want to extend it? Or do I want to take equity? But I think you're going to have a lot of failures. 10-year at 6 gets ugly because these guys have, number one, they financed it at SOFR plus 1,000, 1,200 more, depending on who you're working with. They financed part of this. Some groups have used exceptional leverage to get to the returns that they've gotten. And so your losses are amplified with that leverage. So I'm saying these loans get sold in the secondary market and maybe it's a 25% hit. But if you've got 2.5 turns of leverage on that, guess what? You're in trouble. You're wiped out on that one. So I think it's rates. I don't think it's recession. I think that these loans, even the most speculative, maybe not the most speculative, I think the majority of credible private credit issuers, these big firms that you mentioned and others, I think they've underwritten a recession as a potential outcome. What they haven't underwritten, in my view, is a spike in rates.
So we've recently had what we're calling a recovery in Japan. Has that caused you to take a fresh look?
That's a recovery that you got to really peel back the onion on. We are, full disclosure, our equity portfolios are overweight Japan, so we've loved what's going on there. But the challenges that existed for Japan since the 80s still are there, right? They have the demographic challenges. They have brain drain. What's really turned that marketers around has been, for the last couple of years, the regulatory environment in Japan has changed the way that dividends, share buybacks, a lot of the corporate activity, the behavior that in the US we just feel like is normal, was not allowed or was not encouraged in Japan. So I think it's been the change in posture for companies more than some macro turnaround that's driving markets. Part of it, though, also is, look, the US, as terrific as we are, is a premium valuation market. And nothing cheap. I talked about the forgotten 493 and how cheap they are. When equal weighted index, S&P equal weighted is, I think it's at its all-time high. It was like 1.5% away from its all-time high last week. There's nothing cheap here. And the stuff that's cheap, probably cheap for a really good reason. So if you're a global allocator, you have to look at Japan. They have great transparency. They have well understood and accepted accounting rules. They've got a good market from liquidity. They have this new shareholder-friendly behavior going on. I just think it's a confluence of events separate from a macro recovery that is happening. Not saying momentum's a powerful thing, but I would not say Japan is suddenly going to resume some type of 1980s-like strength.
So individuals are being called the new institutions. Do you see the firm going more into alts as interest from individuals rises?
Bernstein is going more into alts because the public markets offer less upside given what's gone on. And they offer that upside with more volatility. So our investors love good returns, but they love good returns with stable and consistent output even more. And they love good returns with stable and consistent output that are tax friendly even more. So our expansion in the alternative space has really been driven by client demand, where they're saying, look, I want to generate a return that looks like what equities used to do on a pretty consistent basis. And I'd love to get there with stability, and I'd love it to be tax efficient. So that has really fueled the expansion in the alternatives. And then the last piece is what's going on now, this disruption in the institutional LP base that has really driven an outsized opportunity in privates. As a result of 2022, I think that opportunistic desire on the part of our clients, that's the final piece of the puzzle. Our exposure to alternatives has grown dramatically, but it's only just the beginning. It will continue to grow.
Bernstein's grown tremendously since you've joined. Are there advantages to scale as well as challenges?
The advantages are, I think, of our municipal bond business. Munis are, everybody forgot about munis, and now everybody loves munis again with yields where they are. You got to be big in munis to compete. We trade at scale. That's important. Munis are a little bit like real estate. You make money on the buy. And we have a trading architecture within our muni team that is world-class that you wouldn't have been able to build from scratch had you not had $60+ billion in munis. So I think, number one, we've got terrific performance in munis, but it's also the fact that we're trading in big blocks and bring that technology infrastructure to play. And that's what's driven the expansion there. And that's where you need to be big. I think on the equity side, the research business it's very helpful to be big because you want to have global coverage. You want to have specialists in each sector and geography. So there, I would just say having that research infrastructure is really important, and that comes from scale. I always joke, you could never build Bernstein from scratch. You'd be an idiot to today. It would just cost you too much money. But the fact that we're able to leverage having this global 700 billion odd AUM base is really helpful. I think the last part of scale being beneficial is in we're big, and so a lot of groups want to work with us. So we've had inbound inquiries, not just for distribution, everybody gets those, but to be acquired. So I've had groups that have literally come to us and said, we would like to be part of AB. How can we make that happen? And these are terrific investors, great track record, terrible distribution model, awful at marketing. And that's been a terrific combination that we've worked. They wouldn't come to us if we were a fifth of the size or a tenth of the size of who we are. So scale is important. What are the downsides of scale? I think sometimes you can... I'm trying to articulate this the right way. There are points in time where a business is growing so quickly that you allocate resources to it that you never should have. And you do so at the cost of other emerging businesses that then their growth is slowed. So I think it's a resource allocation. You sometimes, when you're big, you have a lot of things that are big, and you start to see a 10% increase in a $10 million revenue business is much more important than a 50% increase in a business just getting off the ground. So I think it does force you to, sometimes it can lure you into making bad decisions on the resource allocation front.
So how do you stay innovative?
I think you stay innovative by never giving up, by never saying, okay, we're done. I love, part of the reason why I love this business is it's never done. We have a great year last year. Oh my gosh, pop the champagne. Jan 1, nobody cares. Nobody cares. So I think part of it is just you can never give up. I think the second thing is to be open to new ideas, things that 10 years ago I thought were crazy. Like, why would anyone invest in that? Are interesting. Full disclosure, not crypto. But I think there are other things that now have a scale that not even 10 years, maybe 5 years ago didn't seem like they were investable. So I would just say be open-minded. The other thing I would just comment on, which makes me not a very popular person within AB or within Bernstein, is you got to close things. You have to end investment strategies that have outlived their usefulness, even if they have clients invested in them. We've made calls where we've closed things. We said, look, we raised this because we thought there was an opportunity in X. We did it. And now it's done. And we're closing.
Can you think of any examples?
I think of in the emerging markets, we've had a couple of strategies, more satellite nature, that as emerging markets in China specifically have slowed, we've said, I think we're going to be done here. I think in some of the areas around, we're trying to squeeze more income out of different asset classes. Now that the yields are where they are, this doesn't make any sense anymore. Public alternative credit is how I would characterize that. These are public strategies, fully liquid, but just trying to turn the needle on generating income from esoteric corners of the market. You don't need to. You don't need to work so hard. Go invest in a 5-year muni portfolio. You're fine. So it's been more market driven where, again, we raise something because of market forces, things change, we close. But you got to innovate, you have to close things that are no longer applicable.
What are some of the biggest risks you're thinking about now?
I think number one, I would say geopolitical. We have two wars. We have a really challenging situation with our supply chain, both in the Middle East and in Asia, that could potentially get worse, and nobody cares. Nobody's pricing that in. So I think that's scary and underappreciated. We have got lots and lots of historical data around elections don't matter and pretty charts that show that markets go up in all different types of administrations with different houses and so forth. This time feels different. So I think the election and just getting there and having a clean and decisive election and just have things operate in orderly fashion. It's going to be, I've said to people, if there was a pill you could take and just wake up in December, I think half our country would take one right now. So I think that noise that will be in effect throughout the year, we have to steel ourselves to not be influenced by it. But I would just characterize the election as a unquantifiable risk. And then I think the third one is more understood. It's that inflation, that we're not done. And you know, we're all confident that we're over the hump and we're on the other side. But what if we're not? And that's definitely not priced in. All you have to do is look at the fourth quarter of 2023. No one thinks that inflation comes back. And risks to me are things that could have an outsized impact on the markets and no one is, and a very small audience is expecting them. And inflation, a resurgence in inflation is right there.
So you mentioned a sleep coach. How do you manage your own media consumption?
I love to read. So I just read everything. One of the benefits of Bernstein is you get on every sell side. We have more. I read everything. Sell side, big bank sell side, niche sell side. I read everything that we produce. We have some really interesting thinkers and they're kind enough to share with me in draft. Here's what I'm thinking about. And I glean a lot from just internal brainstorming with people. I still get Barron's delivered. Now it comes like Saturday morning. It used to come Friday afternoon. I read that. And I read everything. I don't know if it's like ADD or I can have multiple things going at once, but I read everything. So I'm not the right, I don't have a good answer. Like overload is how I would classify it. I do use a highlighter. I would say that's my, if you come to my office, I have big stacks of paper, but there's highlighted portions. And that's how I remind myself to focus on these things. So I love to read everything, but come back to the stuff that's really important.
Alex, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your wonderful insights.
Yo, it's a pleasure. Good to meet you and good to be with you. And thanks for the time.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the podcast, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or share it with your friends. Thank you.